You're listening to Lead, Sell, Grow the Human Experience Podcast. I am your host, Eric Konovalov, and I believe that we can achieve everything we want if we take our leadership, sales ability, and personal growth to a higher level. On this show, we share ideas on how to break through our invisible boundaries, start taking steps towards our dreams, and create the life we desire. I invite you to open your mind to new possibilities, new ideas, and to the truth that everything you want is possible for you. Thank you for being here and welcome to the show. Hey, everybody. Welcome back to another episode of Lead, Sell, Grow the Human Experience Podcast. My name is Eric Konovalov, and I am so happy to be here with you today and introduce my guest. But before I do, if you have not done so yet, get over to Facebook, join Lead, Sell, Grow the Human Experience Tribe, and connect with me there. I'd love to hear your thoughts on the episodes, some suggestions on what can be done differently or better, and just communicate with the listeners. All right, guys. So today, super special guest, even though he'll tell you he's not. He's the founder and president of an amazing nonprofit organization called The Long Walk Home, which is also the title of his book. If you're watching this on video somewhere, you see it right behind me. Ron is a Marine Corps veteran from the Vietnam era, who walked across the country barefoot to raise awareness for veteran suicide. He's responsible for saving many lives, and I'm so honored to have him join us and share his story today. Ron, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much. And, you know, you made that statement, I'm responsible for saving a lot of lives. I am what I call myself Dumbo's feather. You do the work. I'm just there to inspire you, because I've made a change and transformed. So if I can do it, you can. I'm really passionate about this. I'm the guy that walked across the country barefoot to get mandatory counseling for everybody, carried a petition, brought it to Washington. And the reason, you know, people say, you know, you're crazy to do that, you know, because I did it on my dime and took a year out of my life and did this. But this is my country, the guys in the service, that's my family, those are my kids. And what wouldn't you do for your child if they're suffering? So, you know, this group that you have is, Eric, is about sales and stuff and leadership. But you know what leaders do? They take responsibility. If you don't take responsibility, how can you be a leader?
You can't.
And leaders get things done because they take it on personally. It's their mission. It's their calling. It's something that calls to them. You know, there was a point in my life where everything was about money and you were just an object for me to get money. But when I lost everything, I had to reevaluate who I am. And who I had been at that time is not somebody who I wanted to be, because I didn't care about other people, you know, because I was angry, because I'm from the Vietnam era. So it was easy to be angry because of the way we're treated. You know, you say I'm bad, I'll show you how bad I can be. But, you know, when I started to learn the difference and lost that and reevaluated my life, what gave me joy was to help somebody else out, you know, because I had been miserable for 33 years. I mean, I was just one angry guy. But when I started to help somebody else out, I wasn't so miserable anymore, because I'm helping get them from where I was to where I am now. And and why it's really important to me is I grew up in that dysfunctional home. You know, when you're young, you don't realize what you're doing to your kids. I mean, I was that kid growing up in a dysfunctional home where I got beat physically or verbally every day by a guy that had post-traumatic stress from World War II that prepared me for the world he saw, which is terrible. He saw a horrible world. I mean, he was at the ovens. He saw terrible things, what we do to one another. So I thought he hated me, but he loved me because he was preparing me for that world so I could survive. But I became my father. I went into the military. I became that angry guy. And I didn't beat my kids physically or verbally every day, but I would put a hole in a wall or tear a door off a wall. And I did the same thing my father did to me. I scared my kids to death. And then when I started to change, you know, I apologized to them and did best I can to make up for that, because the buck ends with me. Enough is enough. You know, I'm not going to be that guy that says, oh, I hope some young kid fixes this, or, you know, somebody should do something. I'm somebody and I can do something, and I'm gonna, because I can't live this way anymore. It's unacceptable to me. You know, I don't have enough intel to make a decision about whether we should be at war or not, but I know that we can help those guys coming back to at least make it home better. You know, because when I got out, I was angry. I was spit at, you know, and these guys coming back now, they're angry and they're lost, because we were of ultimate service to lay our life down for our country and our family. Now we come back, they don't trust us with a shovel. We have no purpose. All our jobs have been replaced by our family members. So it's like we have no purpose. So what we've done is, through my experiences in life, we've developed a mentorship program. We have 10 challenges to service so that we can help shift you from being angry and seeing the good in life. And then we also help you create a new mission, because, you know, just because somebody isn't telling us what to do and how to do it, now it's up to us. Now it's up to us to take responsibility. When I got out, I still felt like I was in, because, you know, when you're in the military, you're owned by the government. You're owned by this country. They tell you what to do, when to do it, how to do it. And when they'll never tell you why. They might make something up, but so you're, if anything goes wrong, it's never your fault. Well, it's their fault. They told me what to do. Well, when you get out, I carried that with me. You know, nothing's my fault, you know, because I'm not responsible for anything. That's because I gave my freedom away when I got out. I gave it away. So I wasn't free. I was more a prisoner than guys in jail that I go visit.
In what way?
Because I gave.
In what way? When you say I gave my freedom away when I got out.
Because if anything went wrong, I blamed my government. I blamed the church. I blamed the politicians in town. And I gave them all my power, because I didn't make a change. I didn't do anything to change it. So, well, I can't do anything. So they do it. No, I can do something.
What year did you get out?
1972.
And at that point in your book, you write that in 1972, you stopped wearing shoes.
Yeah.
Help me understand, like, what gave you the idea to stop wearing shoes in 1972 when you got out?
Okay, well, what happened before I got, when I went in, I didn't go overseas. I was supposed to go overseas with 5 other guys. They all went, I didn't. And I don't believe in killing. I was prepared to go to prison for 5 years, because I'm real Catholic. I believe it's wrong to kill no matter what. And then, I'm a 19-year-old kid. What am I thinking? I'm thinking, you know, hey, you know, oh, this is fun, or we're doing this, or I'm never going to get hurt or killed. You know, I'm not thinking consequences. I'm a 19-year-old. I'm thinking about getting laid. That's what I'm thinking about, you know. So when I went through staging, my orders were changed. Those 5 guys went, and I didn't think anything of it. I'm thinking, thank you, God, you know, I'm not going to go to prison or anything. And, you know, I'm going to get out of this and everything's going to be fine. But I didn't think about those 5 guys at all.
And your number, you know, got picked. It's not like you went to the recruiter's office. You were drafted.
Well, my number was 34. So I was going anyway. And I had a buddy, another Polack like me. He had a record. And the only branch that would take him was the Marines, because, you know, the Marines wanted guys with attitudes like ours. That we do the job. So he says, oh, let's go in. So I said, well, I'm not going till the FBI take me. You know, I'm not going in, because before this, I was in the Merchant Marines, And I was on a freighter, and we're delivering military equipment to the Arabs. And we had signed a peace treaty with the Jews. And I said, how can we do this? How can we sell weapons to the enemies of our friends? And they all laughed at me and said, it's about money. And then I started to, you know, because in high school, I mean, I was 17 then. I believed everything they told me. America did it for the right reason. And we, you know, all of this. And then when I saw that it was just about money, it just kind of blew my mind. And I got confused because, you know, as a kid, everything is black and white. You know, if you say this, you do that. If you say this and do something else, you're a hypocrite. So that's how I saw my folks in the church and everything, you know, that they're all hypocrites. So, you know, so I went in to hurt my parents, and my buddy had, you know, he says, oh, let's go in. So I go sign up, and I go out, and I says, hey, Tony, did you sign up yet? He said, no. I says, well, you better get down there. I already signed up. I'm already in this mess. So, but then, yeah, I go home and I tell my parents, you know, that I'm going in the Marines. And my father looked at me, he says, what are you going in for? You don't believe in killing. And my mother said, why are you going in? And I said, well, I want to go in to see what it's like to kill somebody. Because it must be okay. The church doesn't stop it. Because I saw my parents as hypocrites in the church. And when I said that, and my mother cried, I wished I could take it back to this day. Because I saw the pain in her eyes. You know, so that's why I went in. And what happened when, you know, so I had all that guilt and everything, because a month before I got out of the Marines, I see one of the five I was supposed to go with, and he's limping. I said, what happened? He said, we all got shot and two died. So all of a sudden, I was just flooded with all that guilt and that shame. Did I do the right thing? Was I a coward? Did I, you know, stand up for my beliefs? Was that right? Could I have helped? You know, all of that stuff came in at once, and I kind of like went numb. And I got real angry, because everything for me, you know, turns into anger. You know, because, and my anger is basically myself, but that at that time I didn't realize it. Sure. And I was angry at everybody else. So I decided before I get out, I didn't want them to have died and suffered for nothing. They fought for my freedom. I can do what I want. I never liked shoes. So I figured, you know what? They fought for my freedom. I'm not going to wear shoes. But the problem with that was when I got out, people would say to me, hey, Ron, how come you're not wearing shoes? I'd say, I don't feel like it. You got a problem with that? Because I'd fight anybody because I was so angry. And when I realized what happened in 2005, I had never told anybody. That's 33 years. Nobody knew why I didn't wear shoes, other than I was just angry and people left me alone.
And when you say you didn't wear shoes, you were just barefoot everywhere, no matter. And yeah. You were in New York at that time.
Yeah, yeah.
So winter time, snow, barefoot.
Yeah. Yeah, through the stores. If I'd get thrown out of a store, I wouldn't go there again. You know, so I got thrown out of a lot of places because I didn't wear shoes. But usually if you have money and you're spending money, they let you in. But they didn't know why. And then what happened in 2005, you know, I'm teaching the swim lessons. And I love teaching little 5 and 8 year old kids because there's no filter on them. They got no IRAs, no grandchildren, no ailments. They're just living life. They're in the moment, man. I love it. So a little five-year-old says to me, he says, hey, how come you don't wear shoes? It's like God took a 2x4 and hit me alongside the head and said, what are you doing? That was the first person I told in 33 years why I didn't wear shoes.
What did you say?
I said, I did it as a memorial for my friends that died when I was in the Marines. And when that's the first time I verbalized it. And when I did that, I realized I had a hollow memorial, a meaningless penance, because I hadn't helped a soul. It was just an act of defiance, just to be this angry guy. And that was my excuse. And I learned, I think really the only freedom I have is to change my mind. You know, that is my ultimate freedom, because everything you do, there's consequences. You know, I mean, how free are we really? You know, we have a lot of freedoms, but it seems we keep trying to take them away. And we keep trying to institute all this fear about everything. I mean, you know, to me, it's sad and it's silly. I mean, this country has changed so much in the 70 years I'm alive. I mean, and I don't know if it's changed or I just see it different because I'm older. But, you know, I'm a little sad or disappointed in this country because I know we can be better and do more. Because I know what we're capable of. We're capable of awesome things. And if I do nothing, I allow this to continue what's going on, which doesn't work for me. So that's why I choose to do something. Because you know what? I used to get resentments when I helped somebody because I was helping people for the wrong reason. I would give a bum $5 to get him out of my face because I didn't want to see him and appease my guilt. But it didn't appease my guilt. But when I truly help somebody with my time and the gift of my passion and look them in the eye and treat them like a human being that they've been heard, I'm truly helping somebody. And that brings me joy. It didn't bring me joy before. You know, people think, oh, if I give to you, I won't have any. But most people don't need stuff so much. They need to be heard. They need to know that somebody cares.
Well, help me understand, where did that change? Because you were running a pretty successful business. I didn't realize how big it was. I started reading your book and you had a gym that where you guys offered everything from swim lessons, martial arts, weight room, cardio. Like, you were running, you were the business owner of this gym. And then this thing happens with the 5-year-old kid and you get an epiphany at that moment. And where did the kind of mental shift happen for you, where it went from Ron to others?
Well, I had been working on paying to go to therapy and counseling because my family harassed the living daylights out of me to get me into AA. And I went to 2 meetings. The first meeting, I yelled at a 90-pound woman next to me who said I was afraid. I screamed I wasn't. But that was a clear indication that I was horrified. And then the next meeting I go to, they say, well, you're going to be in these rooms with us for the rest of your life. I said, I would rather drink than be with you clowns for the rest of my life, and walked out. And then I quit drinking on my own. And how I quit drinking on my own was, I was married at the time to my first wife. And she was pregnant with our first son. And we had gone to a party and I had a few drinks. And I'm talking in the car and it was a quiet ride because I said something that pissed her off. I don't know what it was. Talked a lot, annoyed a lot of people. So I parked the car in the yard home. She gets out and she walks in front of me and I'm behind her still ragging on something. She turns around and smacks me in the face. And all I see is red. And when the red clears, I have her on the ground with my hand on her neck. Hmm. My arm is cocked back to smack her in the head. And when I realized what was going on, I shook my head, I let go of her, I laughed and got up and walked away. And she was angry because she wanted me to hit her so that I could be that monster, so that I could be that bad guy. And that's the day I quit drinking because I swore I would never be my father to my children. But writing that book, I realized I was my father to them. Only I did it a different way. Instead of hitting him and, you know, calling him stupid and stuff all the time, you know, I'd put my fist through a wall or bust something in front of him. They were petrified. But I'm thinking, oh, you know, I'm not like my father. Yeah, I'm like my father. So, and that's, so it's been little steps, you know, when I would do something else and I went to an empowerment seminar, a LifeSpring. And then that's where I learned not to be a victim because I had still been blaming everybody for everything. I mean, I remember going to Adult Children of Alcoholics for, I think, 1 or 2 years And up until the day I left, I blamed my parents for my condition. Oh, it's my father did this to me. My mother did that to me. Then I realized, Ron, you're 40 years old. They're not here doing this to you. It's you doing it to you now. It's not them beating you. And that's when I'm like, oh, my God, you know. So I became more responsible. And then, you know, I think, you know, I mean, it's just, you just don't, I think if I did it all at once, went from zero to here now, I'd probably blow my mind. I don't know. So I did it at the way that was acceptable for me that I could deal with. And then, you know, you think, oh, you know, I'm enlightened now. Yeah, I'm not walking on water, you know. So it takes baby steps to get there. It's like when you work out, you know, you don't go into the gym one day from not doing anything to lifting, deadlifting 500 pounds. No, you do it in increments. And that's, I mean, that's how I had to do it for me, because it's been a learning process. I mean, this, that whole walk was a learning process. All of them were.
You know, like, about it, because there's, you did a few of them. One you did in the Appalachian Trail, the other one all the way across the country, all barefoot. You met some interesting people, experienced God in your own way. Tell me, like, tell us, how did you, you know, wherever you want to start, a little bit about the journey. Like, what, how did you even get the idea to do that, to walk barefoot across the country?
Well, to start with the walk on the Appalachian Trail, that was to create awareness. And how I get the idea to do that was, when I went through my first divorce, and I know that I was going to destroy my business because I'm self-destructive. So I gave power attorney to one of the guys, and I had heard somebody talk about the Appalachian Trail being like America's vision quest. So I figured, you know, I'm going to go in the woods and I'm going to talk to God, because I'm lost, I'm angry, and I'm self-destructive. I got to get out of here and I got to talk to him, because I had, you know, I had put God on the back burner, didn't talk to him, didn't go to church, was angry at him. It's his fault. You know, why does he let this happen? You know, I realized freedom is in a two-way street. It's either you got freedom or you don't. If you want to have freedom and then blame God for the world being terrible, no, it's your fault the world is terrible. It's not God's fault. He gave you complete freedom. You want to kill one another? You know, you want to sleep in your own puke? You want to have a great life? It's your choice. You do what you want. But don't come to me and say, oh, you know, God, you know, it's your fault for this. No, it's your fault for everything. I gave you freedom. You want freedom or not? So, you know, that walk on the first, well, going into the woods was really good for me, because, you know, I walked for 2 weeks. I didn't have any conversation with God. So at the end of 2 weeks, I sat down in the woods for 3 days, and I'm waiting here. I'm either going to die or you're going to talk to me, because I don't care. Because when I lost my sons in that divorce, you could might as well chop my arm off. So I didn't care anymore, you know. So I figured, you know what, I'll either die or get an answer. And either way, I'm fine with it. So I sat there for 3 days, and the third day I says, hey, God, what do you want me to do? And I have these, you know, probably anybody that walks barefoot across the country is going to think it's crazy anyway. So my conversation is right in that line. So you know, I said, hey, God, what do you want me to do? He says, well, what do you want to do? So I yelled louder, hey, God, what do you want me to do? And I hear louder, well, what do you want to do? Then I screamed at the top of my lungs, what do you want me to do? And then I hear screaming back at me, what do you want to do? And then I got it. Oh, I can do whatever I want. And then I hear a sigh like, yes.
Whose voice was it? What did the voice sound like?
It could be mine or it could be God's. God uses many different ways to talk to us.
Which one did you hear?
Well, it wasn't mine, because it made too much sense and it didn't quit. It stayed with me.
Huh.
So, you know, and I don't know, you know, I mean, I believe that God talks to me through signs, through feelings. And, you know, I don't have a direct line to him. I know that he's always with me. I'm not always with him. That's my belief. You know what? I'm not walking on water, so I'm the last guy you really want to talk to about, you know, God and religion. I just have my own personal relationship with him, you know, and it's because of my upbringing. And it's my belief, but I get peace from it, that knowing that, you know, there's somebody there watching over me. And, you know, I could be right, I could be wrong, who knows, you know, but all these religions have a similar thread. There's an ultimate being that loves us. I mean, all the religions, they all have a common thread. I mean, if you're Muslim, Jewish, Catholic, I mean, to me, it doesn't matter. You know, we all look at the world a different way, you know, and that's how I see it. And that's how I can make the world make sense to me. Because otherwise, what's the point? You know, if we're just here for ourselves and that's it, why be here? Who cares? You know, I because then we die and we're gone and all our toys and all that stuff we work so hard for. What happens to what's going? Why did we do it? I mean, I know I'm driven to do things. But, you know, what I do, my moral compass is, does it bring me joy without guilt or shame? Then to me, then I'm doing the right thing. Because if I get joy, I used to get joy out of hurting people. But I had guilt and shame connected with that. So it wasn't really good. You know, I mean, I would fight people. And if I won, you know, I won, but I'm also that monster. Yeah, because look at what I just did to this poor person. Or if I got beat, hey, I won because, you know, you're a monster. You deserve to be beat. So, but when I do it this way, when I have joy without guilt or shame, that is awesome. And when I help somebody, like, and you get to experience that, when I help somebody, it's like I kind of feel guilty in a little bit of a way because I'm getting more out of it than this guy. I'm like so excited that this guy got it and he changed his life and, you know, his family's happy. I mean, that lights me up like a Christmas tree. That's what it's about.
That's really cool, Ron. All right, so talk to me. So you're in the woods. God said three, you know, yelled back at you. What do you want to do? What came to mind?
Yeah, well, then that I can do anything I want. And that was part of me stopping being a victim because, you know, you think you deal with an issue on one level, but then you're still doing it in another way. So I dealt with that on several different levels, you know.
Being a victim, you mean?
Yeah, being the victim, doing that, you know, having that conversation with God, going to LifeSpring and then, you know, taking ownership that it's my fault and, you know, doing the adult treatment of alcoholics. So it was all different levels. And that, you know, if this is the problem, you can attack it from a lot of different ways. You know, if you just attack it from this way, you don't know what's over here. But so when it got it this way, I mean, I probably still have some issues with it that'll pop up, but then I can see them. I don't sit in that anger for 3 days and want to hurt somebody. I like, okay, it comes up, the feeling comes by, I look at it, I see what maybe came up with it, and then look at it and then choose to see it different because that's my choice. I can look at this different. You know, they didn't cut me off because they got it out for me. Maybe their, you know, wife is dying in the back seat and they got to get them to the hospital. How do I know? So when I look at it that way without judgment, I got a whole lot more peace. I mean, I don't want drama in my life. Who needs drama? You know,
I love how you say that's freedom. And I just love it. I love it, love it, love it. Because there are so many people that don't want to look at it a different way. Because the way the second they do, they let go of being who they are. And that's that victim. And a lot of people love being a victim.
Yeah, yeah. Well, how many of us are who we truly are? I mean, I think
I'm still trying to figure it out.
Well, I have a picture on my bureau of me as a child. I'm like 1 year old in diapers with this great big smile like Buddha. That's who I am. I am the light. We are all the light. But we start to believe this when we're growing up that, oh, you're bad. You did this. You shouldn't do that. You're bad. You're bad. We're not bad. We're kids. We made a mistake and we can correct it. But we're that little ball of energy and joy and light. All we want to do is play and be happy. And we still want that now. I mean, you know, so we're in an older body and we have all this, you know, all this stuff around us. I mean, you know, but that's just stuff, you know. I mean, what kid, you know, they get a present and they play with the box for a couple of days before they play, because they don't care. They're just in the moment enjoying and being. I mean, that's, you know, what kid is more worried about a present than his parents? He'd rather have his parents with him than anything.
So you know? True.
Yeah.
Very true. All right. So you go do all these things. Let's take me to the walk.
Well, you know, the walk was, in my life, I've been pretty arrogant, always thinking I'm the smartest guy in the room. And, you know, I know why I'm doing this and what's going to happen. And, you know, I did this walk figuring, well, I'm going to create awareness and, you know, they're going to create a law in Washington and all this stuff is going to change. Well, that walk in the woods was my penance to forgive myself, you know, for sitting on my hands for 33 years, being angry, doing nothing, being a victim. And I'm pretty good at punishing myself. It's part of, you know, being Catholic, a Marine, and Polish, right? The perfect trifecta there. So, yeah. So I just lost where I was already in this whole thing. But
You went to the woods. You got, yeah. That was mainly to forgive yourself for the 30 years of not doing it. Well, the 30 years of perceived not doing anything. I mean, you didn't wear shoes for 30 years because that was your own way of doing something.
Right.
Then you realized you weren't really doing anything for anybody else.
Right. And then, yeah. So then I went to Washington and they had an informal hearing for me. And it was like, I was talking to the wall, you know, cause I figured, oh, they're going to do this. And it's like, you know, I had this novel idea that nobody else thought of. Yeah. A million people thought of what I thought.
What did you want them to do?
Well, I wanted mandatory counseling for all soldiers prior to discharge. I wanted support groups for them after they get out. And, you know, and that, you know, that these classes were available all the time to them. And for all, you know, not just officers, because the officers have a resiliency course, but the, you know, the non-commissioned, you know, guys like us, grunts and stuff, we had nothing, you know, just get over it. So I wanted all of this stuff, but then part of me felt if the government ever did that, that's admitting that war is wrong and they shouldn't be doing it and that we're actually messing these kids up. It's like they denied that, oh, people have post-traumatic stress. They denied it for years and years and years. Now they're finally owning up to it, you know, and that's taking responsibility, you know, I don't really want to get into the whole war and politics because I don't know about it. I just know we're raised our whole lives not to kill. You train somebody to kill for 12 weeks. You put him in a life and death situation where he's going to kill somebody. And then you tell this 19-year-old kid to get over it. He's still in the formative stages of his life. You took the best our country has to offer, the smartest of our youth, the fittest of our youth, and then you run them through a meat grinder and then send them home without helping them. I mean, they do have a transit awareness program. It can be better. I mean, at least it's a start. But to go to a program like that, and then they say in the classroom, okay, anybody that has trouble with post-traumatic stress, raise your hand. What 19-year-old is going to raise his hand and say, I got a problem?
Not many.
No, I know I wouldn't. And even at that age and that stage in the game, you don't even know you have a problem. You think you're fine. Everybody around you, when you go home, knows you've got a problem, you know?
That's right.
Yeah. And we're the last to see it because, you know, it just happened to us and we just thought that's part of life. And it is. It's part of our world and part of our life, what we went through. Civilians don't get it because they haven't experienced it. So I went to that, and then I realized that that wasn't enough, because I realized that, you know what, awareness is okay, but if you don't have a plan in place to do something about it, it's not any good. And if you do have a plan, you got to get it instituted. And if you get it instituted, it isn't any good until you get it acted out on. So I kind of sat with that for a couple of years, and I was taking care of my parents. And when my father died, I was the only kid in our family that would take care of him. Nobody else would, because of who he was. But I'm glad I got to take care of him, because not only was he my father, but he was a vet. And if I couldn't take care of my own father, how could I take care of any other veteran? Because my father made a mistake. But we looked at somebody old and think, oh, that's just the way he is. No, he wasn't always that way. He was a 17-year-old kid, too, that was clueless. You know, he had the choice of going to prison for 4 years for armed robbery or going to military. That's the guy that raised me. But people just see this old guy and they just think he's just an angry old guy. Well, yeah, he was. But he wasn't always that way, you know, and it's like us, you know, I mean, when we get these kids to change, it's awesome. So, you know, I did that walk and I realized it wasn't enough. So when my father died, I had this other brilliant plan. I'm going to walk across the country barefoot, you know, carrying a petition, a sign and a petition. So I had this a sandwich sign that said 18 vets a day commit suicide. So I walk across and I figure, well,
that's right here. That's on the cover of your book, right? The Long Walk Home.
Yeah, that's the sign.
And that's actually a picture of you barefoot walking.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. So what my thought is that, oh, it's going to be like mad, you know, Mothers Against Drunk Drivers. And they got laws into place in a year and it just changed the whole landscape. I figure, well, I'm going to do the same thing. You know, I'm going to get this program instituted in the military, and, you know, and I'm going to be this hero and it's all going to be done. I'm going to go tell them what to do. Well, like the first couple days on my walk, somebody would drive by, car would pull over to the side of the road, a woman would get out, stand there and cry. I'd come up to her. She'd tell me about her child, how he came home, you know, committed suicide. And then she would, and they would all say the same thing. He told me, I didn't believe him. I should have known, it's my fault. Every single one of them took full responsibility, except one mother whose husband had signed the son up in without her permission. But they all took full responsibility. They didn't blame the country. They didn't blame the government, the rest, nobody but themselves. They took full responsibility for that. And the first couple of days I was numb. After that, I cried every day for the 10 and a half months I was out there. Because every day they would hold me like I was that child, cry and repeat those words in my ear as they held me. It was brutal. It was brutal. You know, people say, oh, did your feet hurt? And, you know, how was that? You know, which was tough? Physically tough, the Appalachian Trail was brutal. But nothing compared to every day looking into a mother's eyes that lost a child to suicide. I would have walked 10 Appalachian Trails to not do that one.
How many mothers did you meet like that, would you say?
Every day. Every day I met at least one mother or more. It was brutal. And I'm just walking one road. I'm on one thin line across this country. And I'm doing, you know, averages 16 miles a day.
Which road?
I started at Concord, Mass, where the first shot was fired in the Revolution. Then I went to where the Boston Tea Party was, which nobody really knows because the Irish burned down every ship that they put in there. And then I did Paul Revere's route. Then I did Ground Zero, then the Civil War Trail, then the Trail of Tears Across. And I didn't do that intentionally. It just worked out that way. But what I discovered is we have not ended one war we're in. We're still fighting every war we've ever been in.
What do you mean by that?
Well, the reason, look, the guys in the South hate the North, the rebels and the Yankees, they still got that thing going on. And I get it, you know, and the Irish are still fighting the English, you know, for them to still burn down all those ships. And they're, and with the Indians, it's, that's a whole other world all by itself. And the reason I see that while we're still fighting every war is we don't say, what did we do to cause this? Please help me fix it. Please help us fix it. No, we say, we're right, we're wrong, we won, we beat you. I walked past graveyards in the South where they had thousands of Confederate bodies, and right next to it would be a plaque, a federal plaque, about how badly the North beat the South. I would, if I lived there, I would have tore that sign down. It was offensive to me. I said, how can you do this? There's a thousand dead citizens in there that lost in this country for a civil war, and then you're still berating them, and this is 200 years, over 100 years later, you're rubbing it in their face? I mean, that was, that blew me away. I mean, how can you do this? And then we wonder why, you know, there's this little rivalry between the North and the South. Yeah, I get it. I get it. And it's funny, when I was walking the Trail of Tears, an Indian stopped me that was a Marine. He got out, he says, I thought you were advertising for McDonald's, and I saw your sign. And, you know, he says, he gave me his Marine Corps tie clip. And we got to talking. And I said, you know, I says, when I walked through the South, I didn't get the whole thing about the North and the South, because I'm only third generation here. So, but I says, you know, I was in the South so long, I didn't even like the Yankees. And then he laughs and he says, so then you think Custard had it coming? Well, after walking down here, yeah, I believe Custard had it coming. I get why the Indians have. And I asked him, this is what blew me away, because the Indians in their culture, they fight. And they are proud of their service to this country. And I asked him, I don't get it. How can you fight for this country after we've taken everything from you that you had? He said, this is our land too. Then I got it. You know, you can't take a rock from a piece of dirt and that rock is still a piece of the earth, no matter where you take it or what you do with it. And it's like them. This is their land. No matter, you know, you take the land from them, but they're still connected to it. This is their country, their land. And then I got it, and it was, but it's sad that we don't look to how we can resolve these conflicts. We always look for the difference. Well, you know, you're Russian, I'm Polish, you know, you're Jewish, I'm Catholic. So what? Look at what we have in common. We want our families to grow up in peace and joy. You know, we love our children. You know, we want joy. I mean, we all want the same thing. And then to promote this separation and cause this fear, we're destroying our own country from the inside. We don't need anybody coming over here. We're doing a fine job ourselves, from what I can see, you know, and it's sad.
Ron, it's sad. What's on your shirt?
Oh, this.
Mm-hmm.
This is our logo, and this logo came from when I was walking the Appalachian Trail. You know, I used to hear this term, acceptable collateral damage. They don't use that anymore, but they used to say, you know, oh, these, you know, 18 soldiers a day commit suicide, that's acceptable collateral damage for this war. Well, it's not acceptable to me. But what they don't see is the rest of the iceberg. They see the tip. Now, I went through this town, there was 800 people in this town. And every person I ran into in that town that found out what I was doing, they'd say, you got to talk to this guy. He came back a year ago. He is a mess. He's angry. This one man affected the entire town, and his family is in the impact zone. His wife begged me to help him. She says, and we need help. The wives of these guys need help. I don't know what to do. Help me. The day I was leaving, I see this guy walking towards me on the road, holding this little girl's hand. That was this guy and his daughter. It reminded me of a little girl holding a balloon, because that's the only thing that held this guy to this life, because he was one angry guy. We talked and he was angry, but she was the only bright spot that held him to this life. Otherwise, he had no purpose. So I have it there to remind me, you know, because people say, oh, you know, they want to save the whales in the rainforest. I says, until you save these young men and women, I would kill a whale to kill a whale. I would have chopped a tree down to hear it fall, because I didn't care. Unless you help these guys, all this other stuff to me is in vain. I mean, I know it's good that we do stuff and it's your joy and your passion you share, because we each have something to do. But to me, I work on this because if we don't help these guys, we're going to have these problems with us forever.
Yeah, it's like Mother Teresa said, you know, if you want to change the world, go home and love your children. And these guys are the children she's talking about. It's not, you know, you can take it literally, but it's also metaphorically that children are the people of this world. And until we heal those wounds, until we heal them, the world can't be healed.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like, you know, we had a shelter in the Keys for 2 years, and it was for homeless vets. 80% of the people that went through my doors were children of veterans, and they were destroyed before they even got out of the house. So you think, oh, you know, we're only like less than 7% of the population. Well, guess what? We affect 100% of the population. In my family, there's 5 siblings that are alive. All of us have been in trouble with the law. All of us have done drugs and drank, and, you know, and most of us were in jail. For what? You know, because how we were brought up. That's what we saw. That's how we saw the world. So, you know, these people that, you know, you have a children's program, which is great. You know, you help the kids, you know, but then you send them right back to the sewer. And then they come back to school and you clean them off and they go back to the sewer. You know, you got to clean the sewer out first or you can't help these kids. You know, I'm not, you know, saying that my way isn't the only way or the best way, but this is the way I see it. You know, we got to fix this situation. The other situations, yeah, that's like clipping tree, you know, leaves off of a tree. We got to go to the root to kill the problem, you know? So that's why I do it this way, you know?
Yeah. So talk to us about the Long Walk Home, the organization. Like how are you different from other veteran organizations, and who should reach out to you, you know, if they're listening to the show?
Okay. Well, what we do, I realized when we had the shelter that I didn't help many people. I enabled a lot of drunks in the Keys and they loved me, but there was no consequences. There was no big deal. So I didn't really help them. So what we did, we developed a mentorship program, and the mentorship program, like I said, it helps you shift from being angry to having, you know, a goal, a purpose, a mission. So but we also help people financially or with any, it doesn't matter what the issue is, we'll help them. But the deal is you have to do the first 4 challenges, because if you don't, I'm not helping you. I'm doing all the work for you. And I'm not going to do that, because I learned that in the Keys. Okay. So if you want, you know, we'll pay your rent, we'll do your car payment or whatever, but you got to take the first 4 challenges so that I know that you want to help you. If you don't want to help you and you want me to do all the work, fine. Your car is going to stay in the ditch. I'm not helping you with it. But if you'll put your back into it, I'll be there with you.
What are the challenges?
Well, like the first challenge is, did you do it yet?
I did.
Oh, good man. Good. So the first challenge is, what are you grateful for when you wake up? And what are you grateful that you accomplished at the end of the day? Now, if a lot of people have done a lot of work on themselves, so this doesn't seem like a big deal. But one of the guys we helped, he had a gun in his mouth. And he took these challenges, turned his life around. And then he helped another guy that had a gun in his mouth. And this guy, it took him 2 days to answer the first question because he believed he was that monster. So he couldn't find any joy or anything to be grateful for in the day. But he stuck with it, and it took him 2 days, and it turned his life around. He quit drinking. He started to be more responsible and mindful of other people and to be grateful for what he had. And gratitude is a monstrous thing because there's so many things we take for granted that, oh, you know, life is terrible. And they're sitting there in a Rolls Royce and they, you know, they just had 3 meals and they're going home to a lovely wife and a lovely house. But, oh, it's terrible because, you know, somebody cut me off in traffic. Well, big deal. I've seen kids starving to death in the street. And you think you got it bad. I am grateful that I wake up, nobody shot at me, and I'm going to eat. And I woke up in an awesome bed. And there's somebody in the house that loves me, you know, besides the cat. I mean, who has it better than me? You know, and then when I see these people complain, I mean, I was in India watching, there was kids starving to death in the street. And they were all coming up to me begging, like, you know, like that, just grabbing at me. And then what I did was I picked one kid up in the air and threw him up high in the air and caught him. They all stopped begging and they all wanted to play. They all became that little kid and they wanted to play. And it's, you know, there's such a fine veil between, you know, just that shift in that thought. It's only a shift in the thought, like, oh, life is terrible, to, oh my God, life is awesome. And it doesn't take much. And the biggest thing I do is I inspire people because they say, if this guy can do this, I can do something. If he can, you know, people say, how could, I couldn't do that. I says, if it was your kid that was suffering and you crawling on grass for 2 miles on glass, you would do it. Because it means that much to you. If it doesn't mean much to you, you won't do anything, you know?
It's so true. It's not what happens to us. It's the way we think and feel about what happens that causes our emotions, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. So we have that mentorship program. And then we have, like I said, we do the financial support. And, you know, it makes it easier for me to say no, because I don't want to throw money away. Because I've done that. I've given money to people and then, you know, they're out drinking and doing what, so I hadn't helped them. You know, I know some guys do need to drink. You know, I know some guys are really hurt. Sometimes you gotta, you know, give a handout to get them to a position where you can help them. Because if you're living under a bridge, you're wearing the same clothes and you're starving, but you're spending on booze or drugs, you gotta get up out of there. But then there's gotta be consequences. This is what you're going to have to do if you want my help. I'm helping you this far, but now you got to walk with me on this for me to help you. And if not, then hey, you're doing fine sleeping in your own puke. You don't need my help for that.
Yeah.
You know.
And I'll have the links to the challenges if you guys want to sign up, or if you know somebody that wants to sign up and just kind of get out of that rut, get unstuck, get support, and have the ability to help others who need them. There's a link in the show notes for that.
Yeah, because we're looking for more mentors because we need mentors to help these other guys. And I won't let somebody be a mentor unless they've taken the program, because to me, that's hypocrisy, which I try to avoid as much as possible. But and then this way you understand what they're going through, and then you can give me feedback to make it better.
Absolutely.
And then the other thing we do is events. You know, we're like, we took guys to swim with dolphins. We took them to play with elephants. We're going to go play with the big cats. And, you know, people say, well, I don't want to spend my money on that. Some of these guys that go to these events never got out of the house. They don't go out of the house, but they'll come out for this. And then what happens at these events, we give them a tool. We have a mini seminar, a 2-hour seminar. Or we'll do a mindfulness, but we'll do something to give them a tool. And then they also hook up with their peers. So then they make a friend, or they realize, geez, I'm not alone. Oh, there's somebody out there. And then then they'll go to these events and then they start to get involved. But, you know, some guys are in a lot of trouble, and a lot of people, you know, they want to see a poster guy, you know, they want to see somebody like Eric there saying, oh, I need help. Because that's the vision they have. They have this clean cut young guy. They don't have this vision of this homeless guy, missing teeth, dirty, with, you know, bed bug bites all over him. They don't want to even touch that or get near them. And I get it. I get it. That's a tough thing to do. You know, they're people. And when you donate money to us, we're the ones that do that. The way I look at this nonprofit, I'm working for you. You believe in what we do, and you believe in these programs, and you can ear tag the money to where you want it to go. And that's what we do with it. And we do that job. But, you know, what I ask of everybody, whether, you know, they have the stomach for what we do or not, is, you know what, you see a stranger, compliment them on something, smile, just say, hey, how are you doing? Are you okay today? And look him in the eye. And, you know, that one thing alone changes lives. You know, I got to witness how that changes lives. You know, I still walk with my sign. I walk in the morning. And then, you know, as usual, I'm having a chat with God, you know, checking in, see how he's doing, you know. But this one time I'm walking and saying, God, you know, I can't keep doing this. I'm getting tired. And he says, I know you are, but I'm going to keep doing it, and I'm going to keep using you. I'm like, okay. So the next day I walk, and I'm dragging my feet, and I'm reluctant, like, oh, you know, I'm going to walk again, you know. Halfway through the walk, this 20-year-old kid comes up to me, and he says, thank you for being here today. I was going to kill myself, but I'm not now. Then I said, okay, God, I get it. I'm going to keep walking. So I got to see what that smile and that kind word does. Maybe you don't. You think, oh, it didn't mean anything. Trust me, it meant something to that person you smiled to today. That little compliment about their earrings, or, you know, oh, that's a nice haircut. You don't have no idea what that means to somebody that might have been shut in, especially with this corona, where people are afraid to get out of their house, and then they go interact and somebody says something nice to them, and they see the world a little bit brighter. I mean, I love Christmas time because it's not a date. It's a state of mind. It's where people are like, they were just a little kinder, a little more thoughtful, open the door for you, or smile and say something nice. I mean, why can't we have that 365 days a year? Why not? It's up to me. It's up to you. You know, I mean, that's, if you do nothing or don't give a dime or whatever, what's the most important thing is you reach out to another human being and say, I see you. I care.
Ron, you're one of the most compassionate, empathetic people I've ever met. And I'm very glad to know you. I'm glad to be involved with the Long Walk Home. I think it's an amazing organization. And if there's anything you guys can do, links are here. Tis the season, donate. It goes to a great cause. And Ron, just want to thank you for being here and sharing your story with us, my man.
Thanks.
Thank you.
You're welcome. My kids still love to watch me when I watch Little Mermaid, because I always cry when the father gives his life up for the daughter. They're always like, he's doing it again. I just, I feel things, you know, and I'm glad, because before, I never felt things, and I didn't cry. I was dead inside. I'm alive now.
I'm glad you are.
Yeah. And I hope you guys take a look and read the book. It's on Amazon. And, you know, if you want to get involved, take a look at us. We'd really appreciate it. And we need more mentors. And it's up to each one of us to make this country better, you know?
Very true. Thank you, Ron. Thanks for being here. And thank you guys for listening and tuning in. We'll see you on the next episode. You've listened to another episode of Lead, Sell, Grow, the Human Experience Podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, please head over to iTunes, subscribe, and leave us a nice review. And if you're not a part of our tribe on Facebook, be sure to head over to Facebook and join Lead, Sell, Grow, the Human Experience Tribe. I look forward to speaking with you in the tribe. Have a great day.